Yeah, so this talk will be about this recent paper together with David and Christian here in the audience, and Jorge also in Barcelona is on parental leave at the moment. It'll be about the sitter space time and entanglement entropy and non-conformal sitter scene. I put, by the way, a link in the chat if you want to download the slides to go back and forth. And please also interrupt me anytime. Then we can, yeah, I think it's much better to have like some informal discussion. And actually, there are only 16 slides, so I might even finish early. But otherwise, it would also be nice if there's some interaction, of course. So I'll, I'll begin with the kind of describing a little bit the setup, the hydrodynamics and empty de Sitter space time. It's quite essential that in this case we have a non-conformal model. So I'll say a little bit about that because, of course, if you do have a conformal theory, then the sitter is basically conformed by a conformal symmetry related to flat space. So many things get much more trivial. So it's nice that we can actually go away from that and have some really non-trivial dynamics depending on the Hubble constant, basically. And yeah, so basically what we'll do, we put some matter in this non-conformal model and then we put it in the sitter. And then there's, of course, this expansion. So the matter decays and you can go towards empty de Sitter, which we'll study, and we'll also particularly study this decay towards empty or vacuum de Sitter, depending how you say it. And the second part of the talk will be then about entanglement entropy there. So we compute extremal surfaces, as I'm sure many of you are aware, but also present, we'll spend a little bit of time, we spent a lot of time figuring out the thermodynamics, like from the black hole horizons, and in particular their event and apparent horizons, which in this dynamical case don't have to coincide, even in very late time equilibrium case. So say more about that. And that also was actually a motivation, because normally if you want entropy, you just look at the horizon. But since this is not so clear here, that was actually one of the main motivations looking at the entanglement entropy. And we'll also look at also a cosmological horizon in the sitter, which will play a role. And then I didn't put it in the abstract because it wasn't quite finished, but then the past few weeks we've been working a little bit on also do semi-classical gravity on the boundary theory. So this is not in the paper, but I'll show you two slides of very preliminary results on that. The sitter, first of all, what's this model? And this is the string theory seminar. I didn't want to put introductory slides on ADS CFD or something like that. So it's really just the standard kind of ADS 5 with boundary, where we have this kind of, to make the theory non-conformal, we put just a scalar field or dilaton, if you wish, with a specific potential. And then we put a constant source for the scalar. The source actually we call M. So everything kind of this source determines one scale, and then there's the Hubble constant and or the energy density or the temperature if you wish, or there's always combination of scales which makes the dynamics non-trivial or not. Well, once you fix this scale M, then the theory is non-conformal. This comes from some kind of super potential. It's actually related to earlier work by David, and we take phi m equals 2 here. So just to have a little bit of a non-trivial example, but not much motivation, except that this is actually relatively simple and it's relatively well-behaved model. And since it is non-conformal, you can see that there's a non-trivial equation of state and viscosity, and in particular what you also see what's important is that if you look at, for instance, the entropy density as a function of the temperature on the left, that there's an IR fixed point and a UV fixed point. So if you really go to very high temperatures compared to this scale or low temperatures, then the theory becomes conformal again, but there is a factor between these two things, and in between then there's really a non-trivial dynamics. And the same you can see for the trace anomalies, so the 3 times the pressure over the energy density would be 1 if it's conformal, which is in the IR, the UV, and then there's in this regime where it's not, and the bulk viscosity would be 0 if it's conformal, and then there's a non-trivial bulk viscosity here. So that's if you want to ask more about this model, you can. The model. Then there's a bit of a technicality which I pointed out here. I didn't want to kind of go into like all kinds of formulas right at the start, but after this it becomes simpler again. And I'm just kind of showing this because it will come back a little bit. But once you have this model, we spent actually quite a lot of time, you know, myself, mostly Christian, David, and Jorge, but to kind of figure out the holographic renormalization. So you have kind of this, you have this previous action, and then you have counter terms, and then you have to compute the stress energy tensor on the boundary. And then you get these relatively complicated formulas. Well, we use Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, so you have like a near boundary expansion, and in particular, you have the GTT component, so this is called A. And it has a normalizable mode, so we then call A4. And then there's all these other terms, like phi2 is the normalizable mode of the scalar, and S0, okay, so that's, I should actually mention that here too. So there's like the sitter, so the boundary metric is just the sitter, with S0 the scale factor, and the scale factor, so because it's the sitter, we put it in by hand, it's e to the power ht with h the Hubble constant. Okay, so then there's this long formula as a function of these S0 and these normalizable modes. These counter terms, but I mostly only put it here because the important thing is that there are some ambiguities as with these counter terms. You can always add counter terms of this form alpha and beta, which basically just shift your pressure by a cosmological constant. What is a little bit important here, this is beta times m to the fourth, so that's just a constant basically, and this alpha then depends on S0. So on the scale factor, and in particular S0 prime, so this is kind of the Hubble constant squared, and this is S0 prime prime, so it's the derivative of the Hubble constant. And what will be important a little bit later on is that if you have flat space, then S0 is just constant, so this alpha term doesn't exist. So there's like, so there's an extra term in this holographic normalization, ambiguity, if you wish, which is not there in flat space. And in principle, all these things are just a constant. So in principle, if you're comparing different states, it doesn't really matter, but we'll come back. Then to go to the actual things we were studying. So we have this non-trivial boundary metric, as I was already saying, it's just standard the sitter with a flat spatial slice. So what we decided to do, I mean, of course, you could do several things, like in particular in this Eddington-Finkelstein formalism, you could try to study with some kind of profile and some kind of energy density and have it evolve. But actually, it's not, since there's a non-trivial scalar profile, you would quite quickly get singularities and things would relax. And it's not actually so clear how to get consistent initial conditions. So we kind of had to come up a little bit with an algorithm or a method. And the thing what we in the end did is to start at a very early times with just flat space, Minkowski at some very high temperature. And then smoothly S0 T with a tench go to the sitter. So we basically have here this tench. It is S prime over S, so this is basically the Hubble constant. And so it goes from zero, from flat space, to some value, in this case three. But you have to always remember that this is with a fixed scale, M is equals to one. And this value three, we also will vary. Actually, three is the highest one we do, and the lower ones are easier. And then we tried several of these protocols. So for instance, we tried like a tench, which is faster or slower. And we tried an initial energy density of this thermal state, which is lower or higher. And then we checked in the end that none of this at late times, the approach to the late time thing, after the quench, after this tench is gone, doesn't depend on the protocol. That's kind of what was shown here. There's actually here one exception. So for instance, this somewhat yellow line, you see it actually gets a negative energy density here. This energy density function of time. And that's really because of this tench is really not quite gone there, where it's already quite close to the late time state. So we don't use this one. We only use the purple one. So here already, I will show more results, of course, but here already you can see, especially for this high energy density one where we start, that because of you go to this sitter, so you go to this expanding phase where you have constant Hubble rate, exponential expansion, that the energy density goes down exponentially, as you would probably expect. And it goes down, but actually goes down to some kind of constant value, in this case 10. And this we could actually not, well, there is actually, you can do some other kind of domain rule numerics where you could actually also compute it perhaps. But in principle, this follows really from the dynamics, and it doesn't naturally go to zero, which is also related to this alpha and beta, which is pointing out because this goes to some constant, which depends on your renormalization scheme. Are there questions about the model or the protocol? How we'll go from matter in the sitter into empty the sitter given this scale non-conformal model? Okay, then yeah, the next thing is basically, so since we have this protocol, which is relatively fast quench, basically, so you really see here as the energy density, which starts in flat space, starts constant. Then we quench it here at t equals zero. And now we go for different values of h. So this is faster or slower expansions, Hubble parameters. And so you see that for the lowest one, we managed to numerically evolve. So it's 1/3. You have, I should mention here that we rescale the time axis with h. So it's h times t. So that if there's just this exponential decay, then it would be on a straight line. And you see that especially for this 1/3, this is for a very long time, partly because of this factor h, and partly because it only goes to zero at very late times. So to a constant at very late times. So this constant, this 10, is the same one I showed you on the previous slide. And what you do see here, and in principle, I think this is a physical effect, is that these different values of h, they go to different constants as late time. So of course, any of them, as I already argued, is just a renormalization constant. But in principle, the differences between these things, they could be physical. If you would have different regions of the universe with different cosmological constants, then the different Hubble parameters, then you could have energy density differences. But we don't study this much further. In the end, I think we'll just, for any of these curves, we'll put alpha and beta such that it goes to zero. What you also see, so this is on a log scale, as you see, so this is also why it exponentially goes down, is a straight line. The pressure we could not put on a log scale because it goes negative, or at least it's more natural to put it on a linear scale in that case, right? So you see them actually very quickly decreasing the pressure and actually becoming negative. And if you look carefully, then you see that indeed the energy density here is positive and the pressure is exactly minus the energy density, as you expect, because these ambiguities were all cosmological constant like, so they at late times they have to go to P equals minus E, pressure minus the energy density. And one way to show this even more clearly, and which is also a renormalization ambiguity free, is to show the entropy. So if you show the energy density plus the pressure, then all these ambiguities, they cancel, and you see that everything keeps on going down to really small values at even very late times, where for instance for this h equals 3, you don't see anything. It looks almost constant and the pressure looks almost constant, but if you kind of add them up, then you still see non-trivial dynamics at scales which are 10 to the minus 8 instead of 10 here. So the numerics still allows you to kind of do that. So this is then the end of the end. For reference, I put here this dashed line. So this is like e to the power minus 3 ht. So there are three spatial dimensions. So you have this exponential expansion in three directions. And so this would be if you would have dust, pressureless matter expanding, then it would go like e to the minus 3 ht. In principle, we actually would expect that it goes a little bit faster because we have in principle pressure full fluid, and you actually see at late times that it kind of doesn't, and this is something we'll get back to in the next slide perhaps, or one more. Yeah, so that actually then goes into the question of like hydrodynamics. So if this whole dynamics this is of course like from Adia safety, so it's fully far from equilibrium and everything is in that sense microscopic within this theory, and you could wonder if this whole evolution can be described by hydrodynamics, especially at late times where these energy densities get very small above the vacuum energy density. And so we of course looked at that, and here you can also see again that it's very essential to have a non-conformal theory, as I was saying in the beginning, because it's a very symmetric situation. So if you look at the general hydrodynamic form, so you would have some ideal parts, some pressure as function of the equation of state, and then a shear viscosity and a bulk viscosity, where I didn't even put the sigma mu here, but delta mu is the projection, and the u mu is just the fluid velocity, but everything only goes in time. We have an extremely symmetric setup, but there's still expansion, and this actually causes that if you plug in for our symmetric case, then you're only left with the equation of state and the bulk viscosity. So the shear term vanishes by symmetry. And then that, of course, was one of the main motivations to look at a non-conformal model, because then we have a non-zero bulk viscosity and we can actually compare. So what we usually do, we have this far from equilibrium evolution, and then you have this hydrodynamic formula. So you have like the hydrodynamic pressure is given the energy density and equation of state, you get some pressure. That would be the ideal hydro pressure. And then there are viscous corrections, which you can compute. And this H really comes just from the Christoffel symbols and the divergence of the fluid velocity, which is this trivial velocity I was already mentioning. And then you can just, and we know the pressure, I just showed it in the, from the full idea CFT computation, and then we can compare the two, and that, that's always the idea. And then I wrote here, and then maybe you could already almost anticipate it, but there is a subtlety here. And the subtlety is that the equation of states of the pressure is a function of the energy density. And the bulk viscosity is also a function of the energy density, or maybe you're more used to thinking about zeta over S, of course, so that would be maybe some, or eta over S would be some constant. So in that way, they're always like, can convert entropy density and energy density using the equation of state and the temperature, because these are all around equilibrium. So of course you need to know what is the energy density to compute the bulk viscosity. And I guess I showed this bulk viscosity here, and it's non-trivial from 10 to minus 5 to about 1. But then I also told you that this energy density, especially at late times, is in that sense ambiguous, because, and in particular, it's ambiguous because there's also this extra term which is not there for flat space. And these bulk viscosities, they're all computed in flat space. So in that case, you don't even know the alpha dependence. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to say that in for the computation of this bulk viscosity in flat space, that the energy density is zero in the vacuum. So you should at very late times have a zero energy density. But for this alpha dependence, we didn't actually quite figure out how to exactly how small at very late times this delta E should be. So in the end, as I already kind of said, I mean, a little bit more to say about it maybe, but we just subtract the very late time value so to guarantee that it goes to zero. And in that sense, we kind of assume in a way that at very late times, we're describing also the bulk viscosity of the IR point, also at very low energy densities. And this is not completely trivial also because I'll show a little bit later that we have non-zero, even at very late times, even though it might be empty de Sitter, you would think maybe zero energy density by definition, but it's not completely clear because first of all, this is ambiguity. And second of all, there's also not, you don't go to zero temperature because you have the de Sitter temperature. And I'll say more about that later. So it's a bit of a subtlety here. What we do argue quite strongly in the paper, and this is definitely true, is that this ambiguity, like this alpha, is alpha h squared. And all these gradients in hydrodynamics, they go order h squared. So I think actually what we did is most definitely correct here. But there is this ambiguity at order h squared, which is still interesting. And we have to do something with it, and we have this prescription. But actually, probably at linear order, this doesn't even play a role because this ambiguity is alpha of times h squared. Very good. Well, okay. Is there anyone who wants to comment on this ambiguity or how we define hydro compared to hydro? I mean, maybe in a way it's also clearer if I show the results how we compare with this hydrodynamics, because this is really showing like what was the previous formula for different values of h right here. So h 1/3, 1/2, 2, and 3. So this is this range again, which I was also just showing. So this is the slow expansion, this is the fast expansion. And when you have this slow expansion as a function of time, so here I show the pressure difference over the late times, over the pressure, the energy difference at late times. And the black line is then this the idea CFT result. And it is, of course, in the end, a little bit subtle because we're subtracting the late time value. So you're really at very late times, you're defining something small over something small, but it's not much, you cannot do much against it. I mean, it's really the interpretation is that we're looking at the hydrodynamics of the matter, which is expanding. So in the end, there's just very little matter left. It's just mostly empty de Sitter. That's a subtlety which we have to study quite for quite some time. And then if you have this, if you have this energy density as a function of time, so you compute the ideal pressure. So this is just actually this. So you would put here delta P just being from the equation of state given this energy density, and the viscous hydrodynamics. You can see that even for this relatively small value of h, I mean, it scales with h. It's still quite a significant correction. And what's, of course, very nice and for us also very comforting to see is that the evolution for quite some time actually follows very accurately this viscous hydrodynamics result. So this also probably means that higher order terms are even small, corrections would be small, which we actually saw many times before. But also what's, of course, is even more apparent for all the others, even more so, is that at very late times, it doesn't necessarily go to ideal hydro, it doesn't even go to this IR fixed point. So for instance, they all go to a constant, and this constant is not one. It makes a lot of sense that the ideal hydro goes to one, because the difference with the vacuum energy goes to zero. So you go to the IR fixed point for regarding ideal hydrodynamics. But we really see that this pressure does not go to ideal hydrodynamics. So the pressure doesn't go at the same rate as the energy density as you would expect for this. And what I was already alluding to is that if you have very fast expansions, it's actually something we were, I think, quite surprised about, is that you get a negative pressure. Obviously, we already had negative pressures because it was a cosmological constant. But the negative pressure in this case means that it also approaches the final value from below. So, and since we, at least our interpretation of this matter is that you kind of, the difference between the late time value is what's the matter, because you go to empty de Sitter, that would be a cosmological constant. And since you approach it from below, you would really have a negative pressure. And this is what we find. And that is, of course, you could have anticipated this, as I kind of was alluding to, because the slope is a little bit larger than 3, actually. So which means that there must be some negative pressure. So you can already see it from these slopes, in fact, that we have this negative pressure. At that time, we were also very excited, of course, because we were doing these simulations and it gets quite negative. And then we thought maybe it can get even more negative and maybe go beyond -1. So then you would actually have like cosmological constants can keep on existing. And you could actually have like a self-sustaining kind of expansion of your matter. But it seems that if H equals 3, then it goes up again. So at least for this particular model, we don't get close to having a equation of state which would be dark energy and would be self-sustaining, so actually we don't see evidence for that. So this is the part of the hydrodynamics, and then I'll go to entanglement. So if there are questions about this, it would also be time.
Can I ask, does it keep going, like, do you know if I continue to increase H, does it keep getting closer to zero, or
That's a good question. We probably cannot answer. In a way, I think if H gets really infinitely big, then the whole dynamics is, then M is big and H is big, and the whole dynamics of your scalar field and your and also this bulk viscosity is completely in the UV again. So I think once you have H, which is of order 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 10, you are in the conformal regime again. I don't see any reason why you would deviate from this. My prediction is it would go to 1, actually.
I see.
You should recover. You should recover the conformal limit when for very small H. And for very small H, we actually have some indications that it does. Yeah. IR fixed point then.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, then
quick question.
So, sure.
You said that, well, you say here that the ambiguity might be cured by this other transport coefficient. What exactly determines that? Is that coming from some of these counter terms of the action, or is there?
Yeah, thanks for asking, actually, because we spent actually many months thinking about this, like, what do we do? And in the end, I think, then I put it this formula from this paper by Boromachka, where the full second order terms are there. And because that's not so relevant at order H squared, but at order H squared, it becomes relevant. So you really need these second order terms. And then I looked up at all these terms, and then there's exactly this Xi 5 term, which goes like H squared. And so I think if you add this extra, all these second order terms, right? And since this is something I was very uncomfortable plotting here something which would depend on this ambiguity, physical ambiguity, and it's, I think, something physical. But I think since there's something physical here and there's something physical there, we didn't actually compute this. My relatively strong conjecture is that this chi 5 exactly contains this alpha h squared, like the left-hand side does, in such a way that it would cancel. And then the whole thing would be physically local, consistent. And of course, it would also mean that our computation is also consistent at order h.
Okay, and it's clear the thing you're trying to get is supposed to be free of the ambiguity, because there's some things that could just depend on, you know, renormalization schemes and stuff. But you're saying this is clear that this shouldn't, or?
As far as I know, we only have these two ambiguities, and at least within these symmetries, you could completely cancel it. And
okay.
I mean, it's always true. If you're plotting something physical, then it should be free of ambiguities by definition of an ambiguity. But okay, I mean, it's also true that we didn't check any of these things explicitly, and it's not really in the paper. And I think it could be interesting to look at into it.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, so then the next step, of course, is a little bit more of an interpretation. Also, well, first of all, how this approach, but also what this empty de Sitter space is. And of course, one of the first things, we're not the first to look at the temperature and entropy density and the horizons and all these kind of things. And in fact, quite a lot about the late time empty state is already known, also by Alex in the audience. I think there are actually two separate works we could find that analytically could show that the surface gravity of the event horizon is equal to the Hubble constant. That's actually in this paper by Juan Pedraza and the collaborators, and then Alex Bushel in this other paper showed that the surface gravity of the parent horizon is minus the Hubble constant. And as I'm sure most of you know, at least if you're in equilibrium or if in Hawking's theorem, you can typically say that the temperature of a horizon is the surface gravity over 2 pi. So this would directly be related to the temperature of the horizon. And then, of course, it's curious that this apparent horizon is a negative surface density and could in that sense also have a negative temperature perhaps, or there's actually some speculation in the literature about what is the interpretation of temperature of the de Sitter horizon, is it positive or negative? I don't have much of an opinion about that. But okay, so this is definitely an interesting story. And okay, so the reason why I'm pointing out that there's these two different surface gravities is also that, as I already mentioned it in the introduction, is of course that these horizons, they're actually different. So you have like an event horizon and an apparent horizon. And as I'm sure also most of you know, is that if you have a static or even a stationary system with no time dependence explicitly, then apparent horizon and event horizon, you can prove that they're the same. But of course, here in the whole metric, there's an explicit e to the power ht, and this t is very explicitly there. And the event horizon is really the place from where you cannot reach the boundary anymore, speed of light. And the apparent horizon is the place where if you kind of go out, have outgoing light rays, that the horizon, that the surface doesn't increase. And because the surface, even at the event horizon, even if you don't get out, but the surface already is exponentially increasing. So it makes a lot of sense that this event horizon is not an apparent horizon. You actually have to go quite a bit deeper to find the apparent horizon. I think in the next slide I have also the location actually in the bulk, but the apparent horizon is quite a bit deeper. What I'm just showing here is the surface gravity then for two cases, for h equals 1, h equals 2.5, and then I show in solid here the event horizon. Solid, I showed this h equals 1, and then dashed is 2.5. And what you see nicely is that black is the event horizon, blue is the apparent horizon. So it's the surface gravity as a function of time. And initially, they indeed agree, of course, because we started in Minkowski flat space, and there's no time dynamics, and they have to agree, as I was just arguing. But then you see they decrease, which makes sense because it's kind of a temperature if you wish to think about it, and then the matter dilutes, so the temperature goes down, so the surface gravity goes down, so they decrease. I think it makes sense. But of course, what's the kind of the surprising thing, except if you know this paper by Alex maybe, is that the apparent horizon really starts to quickly deviate from the event horizon and actually goes to -1 instead of +1. of course, in the end, to some extent, it was also a bit of a miracle when we were plotting these things. It's not super, especially the event horizon. We always fix the apparent horizon at the end of the grid, so that's relatively trivial to compute the temperature. But the event horizon, we need to do a small computation, and we actually didn't do that for a long time. So the fact that came out to be one or equal to one units of one over h was, of course, a bit was also comforting. Because a little bit non-trivial, and I guess it has to be proof, of course, because Hawking kind of showed if you have the sitter spacetime that the temperature should be h over 2 pi. But that's really a boundary statement, right? So you have like a boundary that has the sitter and has an observer has a horizon and it feels this temperature of the sitter. And that's definitely how we're used to thinking about the sitter. But the fact that you then go into the bulk and find this event horizon and take the surface gravity and that exactly the same temperature comes out, I guess it's not completely trivial, but it works out, and so it confirms this kind of temperature story. So I think that worked out very nicely, and it also confirms that you should really think about this event horizon as being this temperature as being the physical temperature, also because it's what confirms the Hawking temperature, and it also is much outside of the apparent horizon. And then the next question is like, what are these area densities of the horizon, and what do they do? So normally, of course, we're used to thinking about area densities of horizon as entropies. So then I show here the event horizon and apparent horizon areas for these two same cases for the small one and the solid one and the dash one, the slow and fast expansion. And what's also shown in also an Alex paper, in fact, is that if you have a conformal theory, then the apparent horizon goes to zero area for empty the sitter. So it's really, you can actually show it's identically zero. And so in that sense, it also makes sense that the apparent horizon area is much smaller. It's also much deeper in the bulk, as I said before. And you really see it's like a factor 10 smaller. What's kind of curious here is that even though for this dashed one, so the very fast expansion, so you start at relatively high temperature, the energy density I already showed before, and then you cool down to empty the sitter, but still the area density of the event horizon grows. So that kind of, it shows a little bit that it's kind of a different scale, the event horizon. You can actually, there's also a conformal limit in UV here again of the event horizon. You can also show it should go to about eight, I think, something like that. I have to say that these are the area densities per unit volume in proper, how do you call this again? So you scale out the scale factor. So of course the area increases exponentially, but you scale this out. You also scale out an h cubed to get to a dimensionless ratio, and then it actually goes exactly to 8 in the conformal regime, and we find that. Those are these area densities, but I guess I already anticipated a little bit that we wanted to look at entanglement entropy, and there are several reasons for that. So first of all, since we have this dynamical system, there's two horizons, and it's not super clear which horizon you should take to kind of get the entropy density. And it's even a little bit worse, because normally if you have a stationary case, again, you can go from the boundary you can have a mapping from your boundary space to your horizon space. And it doesn't really matter if you do this like at very equal time or you do a somewhat different time slicing, because things don't depend on time. But if it's exponentially increasing and you don't have this time like symmetry, then of course, if you take Ennington Finkelstein coordinates of Revelman Graham, it matters crucially, because this is exponentially in the exponential factor. Then the apparent horizon itself is also not that is time slicing dependent, so you might not want to do that either. So it's also a bit problematic. And okay, so in India, of course, the other problem is that if you assume that your horizon area says something about the entropy density in the boundary of empty the sitter, if you wish, these things are completely homogeneous. So you kind of automatically have an entropy density and per volume. And if you think about the sitter, at least how I think about the sitter is that the entropy of the sitter is proportional to the area of the observable horizon. So you don't really think about the volume density of entropy in the sitter. You think about it as being on the horizon. So you don't expect this kind of volume law entropy. So I think there are several problems. You can plot, of course, these area densities as I did here, but to interpret it as an entropy density is not clear. And that's why we wanted to go to this entanglement entropy. So then actually this is maybe even clearer also a little bit to analyze to show you how the bulk spacetime looks like as a function of boundary space and distance in the bulk direction. So you have an event horizon at some place and then an apparent horizon a little bit deeper, and they have like these different surface gravities. I should have put it in the previous slide as well. Are there questions about this? Comments? Yeah, so the entanglement entropy, I also didn't put the introduction of like how we just applied it's not really a Takaniyagi, but it's the Hubini Rangamani Takaniyagi prescription HRT. So you really compute extremal surfaces. And we do this for spheres in this case. So this is why here I put the boundary direction as function of R at t equals zero, basically, so time slice. And then you put a sphere here on the boundary, and then you compute an extremal surface going into the bulk. And since there's so much symmetry, I mean, the whole spacetime is completely symmetric, and it's a sphere on the entangling region. So you actually define your extremal surface by it's a one-dimensional line actually, and that also makes it very easy to compute, because normally in extremal surface you have to really solve like PDEs and extremization problem. But since it's just a line, extremizing a line is basically a geodesic equation, and in fact you can write it as a geodesic equation. So you just start at many of these points, geodesics with a certain angle, and you get your family of extremal surfaces. It's not actually that difficult to compute. And here I computed then many of these for different sizes of the entangling region. And then again, I mean, also once you've fixed all the mistakes, there is this very curious surprise, at least for me, is that if you have like, so this is the radius in units of 1/h, right? So if R equals 1/h, then you're exactly at the cosmological horizon. And then it turns out that the extremal surface, if you take as an entangling region the observable universe for an observer at the origin, then the extremal surface for that exactly touches the event horizon. So that's of course not accidental. And then maybe also even more surprising to some extent, or I'm not sure if this was really known, is that if you then go to regions larger than the observable universe, and of course to some extent you could argue, what does it mean entanglement entropy for these regions larger than the universe, because a single observer would not be able to do this measurement. You need to, like, a super observer which can measure also beyond this observable universe. Then actually these extremal surfaces go beyond the event horizon, but they go, and then they can go very far, but they don't go arbitrarily deep. So there is really a fixed surface again. And then that turns out, if you look at it numerically, that the surface gravity of that surface is exactly zero. So I put here temperature equals zero. It's maybe a bit of an overinterpretation, as this means the surface gravity of that surface is zero. But yeah, so I thought it was a very nice picture that if you have these super observers, they can look behind the event horizon. There have been more cases where you can maybe look behind the event horizon, but these were always like in dynamical, in far from equilibrium situations, like Faidia quenches. And in this case, it's of course just empty the sitter. But okay, in many ways, it's a little bit analogous to a dynamical system, because you have this explicit time dependence and this exponential growth. One thing then, since I noticed that this cosmological horizon was a one and you kind of go to this event horizon, it's a relatively natural conjecture that to conjecture that this whole thing, this whole extremal surface is a cosmological horizon, not only in the boundary, which it manifestly is, but also in the bulk. And why? Then I just took a random point that at this extremal surface, you shoot all kinds of geodesics in all directions. And indeed, you exactly reach the origin, but no further. So this indeed means that if you have a point outside of this surface, like this green one, you don't reach, you never reach a flight race to origin. So indeed, this whole extremal surface, well, by numerical proof, I suppose, is a cosmological horizon for an observer at the origin at the boundary. And of course, for the event horizon, this was already true by definition, and here also. And then this the HRT service interpolates it nicely. So it's a full bulk cosmological horizon instead of only a boundary cosmological horizon. Not sure if you exactly know what that means. The last thing I want to say about entanglement is that naively, when you look at extremal surfaces like this, they look very similar to if you would just have maybe a sweat shield or just a thermal state. You would have something which goes very quickly to the horizon for a very large thing and then be for a very long time be on the horizon and then go back to the boundary. And then you would also say, well, then the entropy for this region, the thermal entropy, would be the thermal entropy of the horizon. Because with a factor of A over 4G. And that would be the reason why you would actually make this identification that entanglement entropy for large volumes is the thermal entropy. And this looks very similar. So you would say exactly the same thing. So you would have like a volume here, the volume of the horizon times the metric factor of the horizon. And that would give you the entropy, which is scale like the volume on the boundary. But okay, I already showed you. And that argument is of course too naive. And that's because I just showed you a projection of how these curves look like, but they also move in time. So there's a really extremal surfaces. So they move in the time boundary coordinate and the ADS coordinates, and you can actually see them moving in time. And the larger they are, the further backwards they go in time. And you can actually plot as a function of the size of the extremal region, the entangling region. You can plot the minimum here. So this is the time of the on the horizon, basically on this entanglement horizon, we call it, or entanglement shadow, if you wish, boundary of the entanglement shadow. And then indeed it follows very nicely this log scale. And then if you plug in the numbers, it actually turns out that this whole region, which in the thermal case would have volume loss scaling, actually has a constant scaling because this exponential going backwards in time because of the e to the power ht exactly cancels the volume as it goes to this line. So you only get a constant contribution from that whole piece, which is on this what we call entanglement horizon, which is the boundary of the entanglement shadow, if you're used to that kind of language. One thing I should still say is that, so I said that there's this constant contribution for the entanglement entropy, and these entanglement entropies, they still diverge at the boundary also. So there's an area law divergence at the boundary. It's relatively trivial. Every CFD would have this kind of divergence. You would have to subtract it. So in that sense, I think this is the interesting part of the entanglement entropy. Oh, I can. There's one more sentence in the discussion about this. Then I promised that we will show some very preliminary results. We're working on at the moment. So this was basically what was in this JAA paper. Here in this whole talk, we just put the sitter by hand as a boundary condition, which is also the normal thing you do in the boundary. You put some boundary metric, and that's a boundary condition. But in principle, you can also do, and there are people who did this before, actually recently this has been revisited by Jessler and Loop and also the group of Elias Karicis, where you can, instead of putting a boundary condition, you can demand, as in semi-classical gravity, so it's not really quantum gravity, but you can demand that the Einstein equations in the boundary are valid. So you would get, you just take the expectation value of stress tensor and you have Einstein equations. And in principle, the stress tensor actually is quite important. It can include cosmological constant. This would actually be related to these alpha and beta terms I've been talking about a lot. So in this case, of course, if you back react this using semi-classical gravity on the boundary, then of course these ambiguities, they become physical. They become your cosmological constant. So this is an alternative. So instead of putting as a S0, you put an equation for S0 and can choose basically the Einstein equation. We choose here I put here 4, so there's now 4-dimensional Newton's constant instead of the Newton's constant in the bulk, which are really in principle completely different. And now this, so the scale factor as a function of time is a consequence of the Friedmann equation. So we're still working a little bit on what kind of initial conditions to evolve and to see what happens. I'll show you a little bit two results we got recently. So one, two ideas I had was to just take one of these, the sitter cases, just after the quench, or just a little bit after the quench, you take kind of the energy density there, the geometry there, and you just put it in. And this, of course, is not necessarily a good idea, because, well, in some sense, we demanded that it was the sitter. But if you have this cosmological constant, Friedmann equations don't, well, they give you the Hubble rate instead of us putting it there. In principle, we could then tune this alpha and beta such that at least initially that would be the sitter. So this is something we could do. And the second thing I thought was a good idea is to do more or less the same thing. We start again with this thermal Minkowski profile, a scalar profile and energy density, and then turn on a small U Newton and some cosmological constant and see what happens. So these are then, and it's actually, yeah, at the moment I'm quite happy with the results. I don't exactly know how this will evolve, but these first two plots are actually the same. This is on linear scale, this is on log scale. Here you see again this energy density going down, pressure going down, and in the end the pressure becomes minus the energy density. The energy plus the pressure goes then down. It doesn't have this cosmological constant. You see it keeps on going down. And then on the right here, I plot in blue the Hubble constant, and in red S dot dots on Friedmann equations basically. So you see you start with some kind of Hubble constant, which is really a result of the Friedmann equations, and then it goes to some kind of constant. And actually the dynamics is very, very similar to what we saw in the rest of the talk, and in some ways it's also similar to our own universe, hopefully. Goes to kind of an empty de Sitter, the energy density plus the pressure of the matter going down and down. Then kind of interestingly, I mean, here also maybe the Newton I put quite a lot bigger, and I put a lot of energy density in the beginning. You see also the energy density going down very fast, and it reaches actually almost zero. But yeah, I guess you see it most clearly from the S dot dot. So it doesn't quite reach the positive value here it needs for the sitter, and you see actually that so you start with an expanding universe, and then at some point it keeps on decelerating, and then it changes sign, as you see, and well, it's of course a well-known thing that can happen. Then the universe starts contracting again, and the energy density goes up, and you have kind of big crunch geometry. So it's at least nice to see kind of similar kind of dynamics, but now that the scale factor should be a consequence of equations instead of just put in by hand. I'm a little bit under time, but I don't think it's a big problem. I hope it was interesting to show a little bit this bulk viscosity for kind of these gradients and going towards this empty de Sitter space time. Just revisited a little bit these temperatures of the apparent horizon and event horizon. I thought it was nice that if you have these extremal surfaces which are larger than the observable universe, that you can probe behind event horizon in this setting. This cosmological horizon, which also became a cosmological horizon in the bulk, we're still maybe looking a little bit into. I didn't show you any results of the entanglement entropy as the entanglement entropy itself. So, I mean, we actually plotted, of course, these things. We integrated it, but it's actually hard to kind of extract a thing which is not divergent at the boundary or divergent at the bottom. And then there are some kind of interesting pieces defined by some paper by Malusina and Pimentel. But numerically, it's actually quite hard to separate that from these divergent pieces. So perhaps it's also, in the end, maybe not too motivated for kind of looking at those kind of entanglement entropies. Also, yeah, we have to realize that the physics we were looking at, in the end, you have some Hubble temperature, the Sitter temperature, and the energy density is much, much smaller than the temperature to the fourth given by the Hubble radius. So if you plug in like actual values for our own universe, and of course the temperature of the Sitter is extremely small, like 10 to minus 30, so the energy densities are, it's in that sense not realistic for our own universe. Maybe I should have mentioned that in the beginning, but I guess it's fairly clear. But I think, well, I hope that the outlook is exciting, so we could of course do this back reacted the sitter now and look a little bit how that changes the story. And once also we set up kind of this kind of gravity on the boundary, then there's maybe not much that stops us from really relaxing a little bit of these symmetries and see how other gravitational settings would evolve within say this non-conformal strongly coupled matter. If you have ideas about it, of course also curious to know. Thanks.
Thanks, Wilco, for the great talk. The floor is now open for questions. Please unmute yourselves and ask any questions you might have.
Oh, hi, Wilco, can you hear me?
Yeah, a little bit soft, but we can. Yeah.
Sorry, I apologize.
It's okay.
I don't have camera today. Thank you for a very nice talk. So So I have a question. So so this apparent horizon and an event horizon temperatures, right? They are universal, so they do not depend on particular what non-conformal field theory you look at.
Right.
However, I did not study the event horizon, so I don't know. But I know that for the apparent horizon, if I want to write down the equation of state of the apparent horizon, which what I mean by that is simply computing the entropy density, then it's actually sensitive to what H is, right? So, so in some sense, it's feeling what the matter is, right? So, it's a little bit right. So it's hard to think of this as a thermal state, especially if you think of having it assigned negative temperature, right?
Right.
So I'm wondering if you look at exactly the same questions for the event horizon. So in particular, what is the thermodynamics of the event horizon, right? So so what I mean is that you have this event horizon, you can compute the entropy density. It will depend on H, right?
Yes.
And so
yes.
Now I want to look at, for example, you know, I can reconstruct the full thermodynamics from D equals TdS.
TdS,
basically dT is dH. So did you look at that? How does the equation of state of the event horizon look like in your?
Let me recall. Yeah, so that's of course a very nice question. There is a bit of a, I guess we didn't completely figure out how to exactly do that because the temperature of the sitter in some set of empty the sitter is fixed by H, but
I'm not sure if it makes sense to vary H. Well, H you know, is... okay, so the idea is, so over here, if you model this in a holography, right? So it's just what you study quantum field theory, right? In the background. In some sense, it's not, I kept calling it vacuum in my papers, but whatever we call it, this late time state,
right.
late time state of the evolution. And yes, you're right. So H plays the role of the temperature, but that's exactly what I'm asking, right? So what's...
Yeah, to me, there are two ways. Well, the first law of thermodynamics, you can change the temperature by, of course, heating up the matter inside. I mean, that's, I think, the canonical way.
Yeah, but that
right?
goes away because that's diluted. That's
exactly.
So that's not what I'm asking, right? Especially, you know, especially if we take seriously the Hawking idea that there is a temperature in the sitter and it's a thermal temperature, right? Mm. It's a temperature, and we can think about a de-sitter, late time de-sitter state as a thermal state with a temperature H over 2 pi. So now I am saying that in a holography there is a non-trivial things where we can exploit because we have a non-conformal theory, right? So we have M, and now we have a temperature. Just the temperature is encoded in terms of H. So what I found that whatever the state you try to extract from the apparent horizon doesn't look like, you know, does not agree with. But what you are finding is with the event horizon, something that's a little bit more.
So I think maybe I agree with you. So one way to rephrase it is to keep the. But if you would keep H fixed and you would change M, then if you keep H fixed and the temperature stays the same.
No. But that's another thing. See, that's you. If you want to think it like this, that's perfectly good thing. At the end of the day, temperature is nonsensical. It doesn't make any difference as far as equation of state. Concern.
I mean,
what
I know
makes
that...
sense is the ratio of the temperature to the mass scale. So
that's
if you
right.
want, keep H fixed and change mass. And I'm asking you, what is the thermodynamics of your event horizon?
No, but the temperature of the event horizon does not depend on the mass. It's universal because by Hawking, it's always H over 2 pi. It doesn't depend
right,
on the
but
mass.
You know, but you see, but again, what happens is that. There is a mass, right? So there is what matters are relative scales. So
well, for the temperature, not. I mean, the energy density and the entropy density.
Yeah. So I want to see basically the equation of state. I want to see E as a function, or pressure as a
function.
Of
the mass.
Yeah, so it will be, there will be some, right. And now I can ask a very sharp question. Is it really a thermal state a la Hawking, where I would take a, say, thermal state of non-conformal field theory, strongly coupled non-conformal field theory, and plug there T over M?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying that I know the answer for the apparent horizon, but I don't know.
It doesn't work. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. I think I like this question. Yeah. I mean, I know it works. For instance, in the sitter, if you put a black hole in the middle, then you add some energy, and then the metric changes and the temperature changes in a consistent way, right? So, but okay.
It's
to the, not, the
it's
answer
different.
For your
yeah
it's different.
It's,
yeah.
It's just, I'm asking a question. What is? I'm asking a question. What can we say about the late time state in the sitter?
Yeah. Okay. And the event horizon seems a very credible candidate.
Well, yeah, it's different, right? So again, we can argue about many questions here. But for example, you know, when you do numerics, for sure, you know that you have, yes, you are right. So apparent horizon is deeper inside, but your numerics crashes. And just unless you actually integrate all the way down to the apparent horizon. So it's not obvious, well, try it. I guarantee you it will not work, because you need to, you need to, especially if you do the characteristics formulation a la Chesler, then, you know, you need to sort of have causal, causal.
Yeah, but by definition, outside of the event horizon, you would have causal evolution. I mean, that's the
right
definition of the event.
No. Apparent horizon. I think it's apparent horizon. You will be crashing apparent horizon, because again, event horizon, as you said, you will see only after, you know, you are done with your evolution, very, very late. But you will see that your code will crash and start producing nonsense if you put a cutoff in your space outside the apparent horizon. If you haven't done it, do it on some simple thing. You will
I have
see
not
that,
done that.
Okay,
but,
do it. You will see that you get complete garbage out of it. But it's not, you know, that's fine. I was just curious if you looked at that other question.
No, it's actually
anyway,
a good question.
Anyway, it's a good thing to look at. Yeah. Thank you, Vilka. Very, very nice talk. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Any further questions? Well, it seems that there are no more questions. So let's thank Vilka again for the very nice talk and presenting the seminar, and just end it here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.